Okay, everyone, let's please welcome Alice R., who has volunteered to speak to us today at our Neurodiverse Freethinkers Monday 5 p.m. meeting. Thank you. Go ahead, Alice.
Thanks, Karen. My name's Alice. I'm a compulsive overeater. I think I hadn't really thought of today, I hadn't been thinking today about the fact that this meeting would be recorded and would be available for people to listen to. And I haven't really thought a great deal about what I'm going to say. So I've just said a quick prayer. And hopefully anything that I say will be of something that I say will be of use to somebody. So I'll just introduce myself very quickly. My name's Alice. I came into Overeaters Anonymous in 2007, having been in another fellowship. I got sober in 2005, late 2005. And when I was about 2 years sober, it started becoming clear very quickly after I got sober that my addictive patterns had transferred over to food. But to be honest with you, I think that food was is my primary addiction. I can be working a program in AA, but if I'm not in OA and if my food is not being addressed, and I'm not working the steps around my food, I'm still going to be pretty crazy and probably pretty miserable. I came into AA, but I'm a compulsive overeater first and foremost. So I came into OA. I started working the steps really pretty quickly, I think sort of within the first few months of being in OA. I got a sponsor. I started working with a food plan and lost weight. I mean, I came in and I was, so this was all happening in the UK. I got sober and abstinent in Bristol in the UK. I now live in Berlin in Germany. So I was, by this stage I've been working the program in AA and OA, and, I lost a lot of weight. I was doing a lot of service. And I was, certainly feeling like there had been improvements in the way that I saw my body, and I liked myself a lot more. I liked the person I saw in the mirror a lot more. I was working the program pretty hard, but one thing that I found really bewildering, and this continued to bewilder me for quite a few years, was that I found there were certain things about working the program that I just struggled with that other people didn't seem to struggle with. So, particularly sort of like the daily routine aspects of the program. So we hear people talking about, doing a daily step 10 or having a daily meditation routine. And I would be able to keep up a routine of that kind for some days. So, it might be like a week or a couple of weeks with all of the kind of the force of will that I could exert, I might be able to, do a sort of step 1, 3, and 7 morning prayer routine for a couple of weeks, and then it would just fall by the wayside. And I found that inability to like build routines really, really frustrating. And at the same time, I'd kind of see that it felt as if like my moods were much less stable than other people that I had, I would see people coming into the rooms after me, and it would seem as if they had a kind of level of sort of emotional sobriety that felt quite inaccessible to me. Although I was, content more of the time, I was also, my moods would go very, very low a lot of the time, and I found it quite difficult to maintain abstinence. I always had what might be referred to as fuzzy abstinence for quite a long time, the longest period of time that I think I've ever kind of managed to have solid abstinence is a year. Over the course of those years, I have been abstinent for the majority of that time, but I've not been able to build up any sort of extended, multi-year periods of abstinence. There have been slips and relapses along the way. And a lot of that was just because I still found my moods really, really unmanageable. Really, you know, they would go very high and they would go very low. And then there were just these, you know, I still found it, you know, just in terms of like living in a house that wasn't chaos, and that really difficult. And the longer I was in recovery, the more that sort of just seemed like it wasn't normal. It seemed like I was struggling with stuff that other people weren't struggling with. I started studying for a part-time university degree. And that was, you know, as study had always been, was just incredibly painful. If I was interested in the subject, it was really easy. But if I wasn't interested, I found motivating myself, I found focusing just impossible. So, I'm not entirely sure when I started looking at the possibility that I might have ADHD. I was certainly in my late 30s by this point, you know, and my recovery just didn't feel as if, you know, I still struggled with relationships. I was single and celibate all of my 30s, basically. It just still seemed to be lots of things about being a sober, abstinent person that I struggled with that other people did not seem to struggle with. I watched friends, you know, getting into relationships, getting great new jobs, having kids, and I was still really flailing in so many areas of my life. And eventually it started, you know, the more I read about ADHD, the more I like kind of self-diagnosed. It's like, I think I have ADHD. I think I need to get diagnosed with ADHD. All the, you know, the pieces started falling into place. And it took me a long time to get self-diagnosed, to get actually officially diagnosed, which I think is quite a good marker of having ADHD if it takes you 4 or 5 years to get diagnosed, because they send you letters which you then lose, and then you forget to call them to tell them that you've moved house. All of that kind of stuff. Eventually I did get diagnosed. I got a diagnosis of ADHD primarily inattentive. And that was 4 years ago now. And it's just made so many things make sense. As I'm doing this share, so I started dating around about the same time I got diagnosed, actually. I threw myself back into the dating pool. And I found that it's hard work. I'm not built for it, personally. But I went on a date on Saturday and it was really successful. It was probably like the first ever in truly successful date I've ever been on. The guy messaged me earlier today to ask if I wanted to go on another date tomorrow. And I said yes, and I've not heard from him since. It's like 11 hours ago. And one of the, you know, one of the things I didn't know about, because I mean, I think ADHD is, you know, I'm 46 now. I got diagnosed when I was 42. You know, I think I'm a fairly stereotypical example of, you know, someone assigned female at birth, in whom all of the kinds of, you know, stereotypically female symptoms of ADHD were just completely missed, because they just weren't, you know, I didn't fit all of the stereotypical criteria. I was not physically hyperactive, I'm mentally hyperactive. You know, all of that was missed. And one of the things that, you know, I found about in the period of the diagnosis was this thing, rejection sensitive dysphoria, which is essentially, for those who might not know what that is, means that, I mean, what it says on the tin, I have in the past found rejection of any kind, whether it's, you know, sort of like being disagreed with, or the breakup of a friendship, or not understanding why someone isn't contacting me, or things like this, where someone takes me 12, where it takes 12 hours for someone to respond to a text, and I'm wondering whether they've ghosted me. My emotional response to that has in the past been crippling. So, you know, like crippling sadness, anger, frustration, and bewilderment. And I talk about that because, I think the really important thing for me is that now that I know that that is the case, now that I know that that is a part of my emotional makeup, And it's not just that that's my emotional makeup as a compulsive overeater, addict, alcoholic, you know, person with a spiritual malady. It is also part of my makeup because that's the way my brain works. You know, it's part of my, you know, my neurological function that I react to certain situations in a, I'm not going to say disproportionate way, but, you know, more strongly than others without my neurodivergence might. It makes a lot of sense in my compulsive eating. You know, if my emotions, even before I was diagnosed, I used to say I'm a feelings-based creature. I'm a feeling-based life form. You know, I feel hard. I feel happy. I feel very happy. I feel very sad. I feel very frustrated. My emotions feel larger than other people's. And being able to attach that not just to, you know, my addictive, you know, the nature of the spiritual malady, but also just the fact that as somebody with ADHD, I feel emotions differently, was incredibly useful. It took the power out of it. I didn't have to feel like I was struggling in ways that my peers were not, that there was something wrong with me. It wasn't that there was something wrong with me, it was, something different about my brain. And I found that kind of quite transforming, really. But it also makes sense of, you know, the fact that if I felt these feelings that were so much larger than other people's, that I had to have somewhere to go with them. I had to have something that would turn the volume down. I had to have something that would numb me out. And so my relationship with food started making so much more sense. Just very quickly, another thing that I want to say is that for a long time, it felt quite apparent that my relationship with refined sugar was deeply problematic. And I tried really, really hard to be able to include sugar in my diet, in my food plan, not a diet, but in my food plan, in moderation. And it just never worked. I always ended up binging again. For me, that is also, my brain works better. As a person with ADHD, I am more cogent when I'm not eating sugar on a day-to-time basis. I do eat maple syrup, I do eat honey in very small, not regular quantities. I eat a lot of fruit because I do still like sweetness. And I do occasionally also eat no sugar confectionery. But again, very, very rarely. But yeah, I mean, like when people, I've found it a really good get out. When people ask me recently, you know, over the last few years, when people ask me why I don't eat processed sugar, I'm quite open about it now because, you know, the same way as if people ask me why I don't drink alcohol, I'll say it doesn't agree with me. I really like being able to say I don't eat processed sugar because of my ADHD. It's just, you know, I'm much more mindful. My brain works better when I don't eat it. It's a good little get out course. The other thing, you know, one of the other reasons why I started wondering whether there might be something different about my brain to those, particularly, at one point I was very, very involved in my local Buddhist community and I was doing a lot of meditation and I found meditation incredibly painful because my brain was so busy. I could not empty my brain. When people talked about, you know, those moments of calm, 10 or 15 minutes into a meditation, I had some experience of what they were talking about, but I became really conscious of the fact that it seemed harder for me than other people. And I think that's another thing that is really important in terms of like how I work my program now as somebody with ADHD is that I do sitting meditation of the classic style. I am much kinder to myself. If I'm in one of my home groups in my other fellowship is a meditation meeting with a 20-minute sit. And I don't try and sit for 20 minutes. I now know that that's probably just not going to be very useful for me. I find writing meditation much more useful. Walking meditation I've also found really useful. I will use, you know, I was at that meeting yesterday. I'll try and meditate for 10 minutes maybe. 7 to 10 minutes, and then the rest of the time I will use writing to my higher power. Although I describe myself as an agnostic, I'm kind of building a new relationship with a higher power that probably is much more in line with, you know, the kind of descriptions of a higher power that, that, you know, more classically spiritual members of our fellowship would understand. But, you know, I could talk about, you know, the free thinking aspect of this meeting for another 20 minutes. So I won't. I will try and focus more on the neurodivergent side of things today, because it feels less complicated to me at this stage. But yeah, I mean, I do think that my recovery has been more testing. I don't know, you know, I can't speak for everybody. I know that there have been times where I have felt as if it was impossible for me to work the kind of program that I heard other people talking about in meetings and have done for more than a decade now, because of my ADHD. And it is really vital for me. You know, I relapsed on sugar. Well, I just relapsed, you know, but it started out with sugar a couple of years ago and really only kind of got myself back towards abstinence at the beginning of this year. So, yeah, I guess I'm sort of, you know, sort of 6 or 7 months abstinent now. In that process of coming back into the rooms, because I pretty much left OA and then came back probably about 9 months ago now, was able to go back to my old home group in Bristol, even though I was in Berlin because of Zoom. So, you know, thank our higher powers for COVID in some ways, because I really do feel like that was a massive part of my return to recovery, was being able to sit in a Zoom room with the people who I had got abstinent with in the first place, or some of them anyway. But in those kind of 6 or 9 months, it's felt really important to me that I've been able to kind of just be really honest with myself about what it is possible for me to do as, you know, somebody who wants to work this program to the best of my abilities, but has been trying to do that really, really hard and making the same mistakes and, you know, trying the same patterns, you know, trying to have a daily meditation routine and trying to do my prayers at the same time every day and all of that kind of stuff. You know, that just, it hasn't worked for the last 13 to 14 years. And so I've decided to stop beating myself up about it and try something new. And I find that the more that I do that, the more I give myself permission not to do these things or to find my own ways of doing them or to just shake routines up or just to let go of the idea of having a routine, the more likely I am to be able to fit things into my day in a way that feels useful and manageable. So, you know, I have a home group in my other fellowship. I'm looking for another home group now because my home group in the UK is going back face to face. So I need to find an online home group. There isn't really an English speaking OA meeting with any real recovery in my part of Germany. It may well be that there is another one. So Footsteps has been like really incredibly helpful for me. And I have a feeling that probably my home group will end up being a Footsteps meeting. But I have to give myself permission not to be there every week, because sometimes that's not going to happen. The more permission I'm able to give myself to be imperfect because of my ADHD, the more it stops being about my ADHD and starts being about just, I give myself permission to be imperfect. So I give myself permission for my food to be imperfect. I don't report it in every day the way that, you know, I'm sure my other sponsorship sisters do. But I do my best, you know, and my sponsor knows that I'm always doing my best. Whatever my best ends up looking like, I'm doing my best with the brain that I've been given. And you know, the willingness that I have, which, like I say, I've been in and out of relapse. Majority of these 14 years, I have been abstinent, imperfectly so. But I've been in and out of relapse a handful of times in that period of time. I've always come back. I've always kept coming back. Because for me, this is the only place I've ever got any serenity around food. And today, just tangentially, in a very ADHD fashion, going back to the text message that I'm waiting for from this lovely gentleman that I met on Saturday. Before I away, I mean, I would have been eating for the last 12 hours. I would have been sitting there with my phone in my hand, waiting for this man to message me. And in my other hand, there would have been snacks to my left and my phone in my right hand. And I just would have been refreshing with my right and eating. And if there isn't a message by bedtime, then, you know, the one thing that I know is that I will plan my food and I will leave a message for my sponsor saying, do you know what? I'm really upset. This man didn't get back to me and I think I've been ghosted, but I don't need to eat on it today. And that is a miracle. That is a miracle. So, as you know, a neurodivergent person in recovery, you know, my version of progress, not perfection, is slower and much, much less perfect than a lot of other people's. But I'm here, I'm abstinent today. I'm incredibly grateful for my abstinence, incredibly grateful for my sobriety, really grateful for these meetings. I'm really grateful just to be able to kind of be in a meeting where I can talk about this stuff. And not feel like it's really interesting. And I'll close on this. When I moved to Germany and moved into a new fellowship, I'm with an awful lot of people who are much younger than me, and also people who are from the States, where I think understanding of ADHD and diagnosis of ADHD is just, you know, much more widespread. So I've moved to an entirely new country, and it feels as if, you know, I'm also medicated. I'm newly medicated. I haven't talked about that at all. Maybe I will talk about that, you know, in another share, but I've just started taking Vyvanse about 6 weeks ago and it's made a huge difference. That has made a huge difference. But yeah, you know, it feels like having an understanding of the way that my ADHD has affected my compulsive overeating has just completely changed my recovery. And I'm incredibly grateful for that. I'm just grateful to know myself better. You know, the better I know myself, the better I can be of service, because, you know, hopefully I can carry a message, and hopefully I've done that today. So I'll leave it there. Thank you.